From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. It's the quiet before the storm today in Washington. Oral arguments are expected to begin next week in President Trump's impeachment trial. And today we learned that star lawyer Alan Dershowitz is on the president's legal team and will argue the case against impeachment on the Senate floor.
Let's bring in our Friday politics roundtable. We've got Kimberly Atkins. She is Washington reporter for WBUR. Hi, Kimberly.
Hi there.
And Domenico Montanaro, NPR senior political editor and correspondent. Domenico, hello to you.
Good to be with you.
And let's start with you, Domenico. Weigh in on that news that Donald Trump's impeachment defense team is getting a boost because he's adding Ken Starr, who led the investigation into Bill Clinton in the 1990s, which led to Clinton's impeachment, and the Harvard law professor Alan Dershowitz.
Pair of sort of celebrity attorneys in some respects, sort of obviously the irony of having Ken Starr on the team being someone who prosecuted essentially a president now to make the case in some ways for President Trump should be really notable and interesting. He spent a lot of time on Fox News over the last few years. He didn't always have great things to say about President Trump or the facts as they relate to this case. So it'll be really interesting to see what people wind up pulling out from what Ken Starr has said previously about this. Alan Dershowitz has kind of hinted at the fact that he is lobbying at least or trying to be part of this team. So we'll see how this winds up manifesting before the senators and if they have any hard questions for having them on the team.
Yeah, and they are about to get very busy in the next couple of days. A lot of people are. Kimberly, walk us through what we should expect to see over the next 48, 72 hours as the impeachment trial gets underway.
Yes. Well, what we will see on Tuesday is for really the formal arguments to begin. Some of the preliminary things happened yesterday with the Chief Justice being sworn in and 99 of 100 senators being sworn in. The final one will happen sometime before Tuesday. And Tuesday at 1 p.m. is when the proceedings will begin. We will see the impeachment managers who were chosen by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi begin to make the case for impeachment, and the president's team, which now includes the new lawyers you talked about, begin defending him.
I want to ask you all about some of the emerging details that we're learning. Lev Parnas, the indicted associate of Trump lawyer Rudy Giuliani, has been making a lot of news this week. He claimed that Trump and even Attorney General William Barr knew about the effort to pressure Ukraine to announce investigations of Joe Biden. And yesterday, even though there is photo and video evidence, Trump denied knowing him.
I don't know him at all, don't know what he's about, don't know where he comes from, know nothing about him. I can only tell you this thing is a big hoax. It's a big hoax.
Kimberly, I mean, the Parnas revelations really show that there's so much the senators don't know.
Yes, and it goes both ways, right? So on the one hand, it bolsters the argument of Pelosi and Democrats that say, look, there is evidence here that was being withheld during the House investigation, and that is continuing to come out. So the Speaker was right to wait, to not immediately transfer these articles of impeachment, and mm-hmm. that it puts pressure on senators to want to get these documents, to want to hear from witnesses. We still are not sure whether or not we'll hear from them. It's up to the senators to decide along the way. But on the other hand, some have pushed back, like Senator Susan Collins mm-hmm. have pushed back, suggesting that the investigation is incomplete and the Democrats are rushing this.
Yeah, Domenico, Republican Senator Ted Cruz has mentioned witness reciprocity. If Democrats call John Bolton, Republicans should call Hunter Biden. Do you think that we will see Hunter Biden testify?
No, I don't. But I think that and what Democrats argue with that is that that's a straw man because he's not related to the actual charges at hand against President Trump. You know, he may be part of the debate, part of the dialogue, part of, issue that was going on in Ukraine, obviously. But they feel to the heart of this matter, he's not a fact witness to mm-hmm. President Trump's withholding of aid. That's a political move. What Democrats are saying is you've got all these documents, all these people who do know information, who either have come forward, have not come forward, but who Mitch McConnell in the Republican-run Senate are not allowing to come forward.
So maybe not Hunter Biden, but what about somebody else?
You know, I don't know who Republicans would call or even have on board as far as this reciprocity that Ted Cruz talks about to try to bring on board who might satisfy them to bring forward the kinds of witnesses that Democrats want. Because frankly, in this process, when the talk has been of the substance of what's happened here, that's been on the Democrat side. When they've talked about process, which was controlled by Democrats in the House, that's where Republicans were able to score some political points. But now they control the process and the substance isn't very much on their side.
I mean, can we talk about something else, though? I mean, Kimberly, lawmakers on both sides of the aisles this week said they felt the weight of history as Chief Justice John Roberts swore them in yesterday. But isn't this talk of being impartial kind of just talk? I mean, we know as it goes into the Senate that folks have already said where they weigh on this.
Right. You know, yes and no. I mean, there have been a lot of comparisons about this is a trial and juries should be impartial. It's a political process. It's not a judicial process. It is why the framers gave the Senate this power to remove the president. They were fully aware that there would be politics. People would bring their own political views to this. But at the same time, they've taken an oath to do impartial justice, to weigh in this impartially. That means listening to witnesses. That means calling witnesses if they would like to see them. And so in that sense, it has to be this idea has to be embraced that this is supposed to be a serious exercise. It's removing a president from office. You have the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court there. So the seriousness is expected to be upon the shoulders of all 100 of these senators. But don't expect them to leave politics at the door.
Domenico, I want to go back to Lev Parnas because this was a pretty big story all week long. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said today to the conservative radio host Hugh Hewitt that he was unaware that the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, was being surveilled as a part of this shadow campaign to pressure Ukraine into digging up dirt on Joe Biden. Here is Mike Pompeo.
Yeah, I'd never heard about this at all, Hugh.
Okay. Now,
until the story broke, I had best of my recollection, I'd never heard of this at all.
And after this interview, he then later said, Pompeo later said that the administration would look into it. But Domenico, do you think that any of these Parnas revelations will go anywhere and have any sort of lasting impact?
Well, I mean, it depends on in the history books or if we're talking about in the next 2 weeks, because in the next 2 weeks, probably not. But in the history books, absolutely, because, you know, it's another fact witness. And yes, he certainly has his own motivations. But as Nancy Pelosi said yesterday, when somebody comes forward who has firsthand information, you're supposed to check out that information. You're supposed to try to verify. You're supposed to try to do an investigation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it should be noted that when Chief Justice John Roberts read the oath to the Senate, he said that part of what it includes is that they will vow to do, quote, impartial justice. And, you know, you have Mitch McConnell already coming out and saying that he's not an impartial juror. And sure, we know that these folks have biases one way or the other, but they're supposed to try, put on a good show, and, you know, do their best intellectual honesty, you know, to look into the matter and see if there's anything to it. And instead, you know, we wind up in a political fight with Republicans dug in, all in on President Trump's mm-hmm. side.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about 2020 now. There was a Democratic debate in Iowa this week and a public fight between Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders over whether a woman could win in 2020. Domenico, what did we learn about the state of the race this week?
Well, the state of the race is kind of what it's been in some respects. It's in flux. You have a clear top tier of four candidates, and you have a clear divide among this progressive wing and this more moderate wing in the party, although I hesitate to call it moderate, given that, you know, the public option 10 years ago was seen as something that was so odious that Republicans could never get on board. Now it's the moderate play mm-hmm. when it comes to health care. But you know, you've still got this Buttigieg and Biden thing against Warren and Sanders, and with a little bit of overlap when it came to this kerfuffle about whether a woman could or couldn't win and whether what was said or wasn't said and this handshake after the debate and whether they actually you know, took offense to that. It looked like Elizabeth Warren didn't like that. She felt that Bernie Sanders lied and didn't say what she said he'd said. Now, we don't know what the actual truth was. None of us were in the room there.
Right.
We know Senator Sanders says a woman can win, and that's what it is. And frankly, in our polling, when you look at the polling, the characteristic that gets the highest favorability ratings for what someone would want to vote for is a woman.
Kimberly, less than a minute here. Michael Bloomberg, what about him? He got two endorsements this week from members of Congress. Stephanie Murphy from Orlando, Max Rose from New York. He was not on the debate stage in Iowa. Did he still have a good week?
As long as he has a lot of money, he's still not one to be ruled out. And he's planning on the, you know, the strategy that looks at Super Tuesday, focuses there. And so I don't think we have seen the last of Mike Bloomberg, and we'll definitely see a lot more of him in the months ahead.
He has spent a lot of his money, but he still has a lot. Kimberly Adkins, Washington reporter for WBUR, Domenico Montanaro at NPR. Thanks to you both.
Thanks to be with you.
The Grammy Awards will air later this month on January 26th, and for the third consecutive year, vocalist PJ Morton is up for multiple nominations, including Best R&B Album and Best R&B Song for his latest album, Paul. So if you love me, just say so. That's the song Say So, featuring JoJo. These nods are not only a professional notch, but a personal one, too. Just a few years ago, Morton, who is also a keyboardist for the band Maroon 5, had actually thought about giving up on the idea of a solo career. PJ Morton joins us to talk more about his music and finding his voice. PJ, congrats on your Grammy nods and welcome to Here Now.
Thank you, and good to be here.
So you won a Grammy last year for Best Traditional R&B Performance, but you've been nominated for more than a dozen over the last few years. Do you still get giddy about being nominated?
Yeah, I do. I actually, it never gets old to me. It's also made me very comfortable with losing Grammys.
Yeah.
12 to 1, you know. But no, it's I always tell people that the nomination is really the win, you know. There's so much music, so much good music coming out all the time, especially now with people having the freedom to drop music when they want. So to be in that small number is still such a special thing.
Yeah. You've said the album you're nominated for, Paul, that's your first name for those who don't know.
Yes.
Reflects the purest form of who you are. There's a backstory here. You moved to LA for a time before deciding to go back home to New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
What was it about your experience here? I'm in LA working on your music that compelled you to leave?
Well, it was probably a bunch of layers. But one of the things was, you know, I found success with Maroon 5, and we've been doing, you know, very well since I've been in the band, almost 10 years now. So I think that started to satisfy the competitive side of me in music. So I started to lean more internal as far as the solo stuff. And I wanted to say something, and I wanted to say it the way I wanted to say it. And musically, you know, I wanted it to sound the way I wanted it to sound. I was blessed enough to have all these hits with Maroon. So I think it just started to make me hate that competitive side of it. It's like, man, I'm blessed enough to be in this huge band, and we're doing great. You know, I've wanted that my whole life, to play the Grammys and to play the SNL and to, you know, we played the Oscars, all these things. So it just made it harder for me to hear these critiques when I went to these labels and was talking about my music. It's like,
what were some of the things they were saying about it?
I remember specifically them asking me to work with certain producers who were hot on radio right now, but had nowhere near my sound. Or, hey, what do you think about, you know, just let us give you one radio type, you know, hit, and then you could do whatever you want. it was just harder for me to hear all that stuff. So the fact that they were trying to make me an experiment when I'm in a band that just had five number one hits, and it just showed me that I wanted to go deeper and to mean something more than just a hit. So that was part of it. LA being super expensive was a part of it. I'm like, what am I don't have to be here. It was a combination of things that just I felt like it was time to go.
What did you find when you went home to bring you closer to yourself? You know, when we think about home, we do think about it is maybe, as you mentioned, the purest form of who you are because it's where you grew up and got into yourself. What did you find once you got home?
Yeah, what was crazy is I didn't know exactly what I was looking for. You know, I just felt a pull to go home. Before L.A., I'd lived in Atlanta. College, I'd lived in New York and then L.A., so I'd been all these places, and I just felt a pull to go home. I didn't know exactly why. My plan was to not do music, but to start a sneaker store, you know?
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I've always been the young buck of the crew. You know, I started playing very early at 14, and I got back and I realized, not just in age, but in career-wise, I was in a place that a lot of my friends and a lot of these artists had not been to, and I had to accept that maybe I'm a leader now. You know, I didn't expect that.
Not the young one anymore.
Yeah, not the baby anymore. You know, these guys were looking to me for certain answers, and that is kind of how Morton Records was started to form on my mind. I'm like, man, I'm trying to get away from music, but it's needed, and I can't complain about it if I don't do anything about it.
Your music on the album, Paul, has kind of a late 90s vibe going on. I actually love the interludes you have. It reminds me very much of The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. Am I right in what I'm hearing?
Yeah, it's always some of that. I mean, Miseducation was a huge influence on me. I just happened to be a kid who loved 60s and 70s music. You know, the Beatles, Stevie, James Taylor, D'Angelo.
And we should say, like, all of that represented itself in the 90s. So it's all cyclical.
Exactly. So they all just snuck in there on Paul.
One song that stood out for me in particular is the track Buy Back the Block, which begins with a clip of a news report on the death of rapper Nipsey Hussle. Let's listen.
Sources within LAPD familiar with this investigation confirming that rapper Nipsey Hussle was shot and killed outside his clothing store here.
Peace, I was
talking
Hussle.
With a lot of people out here who are very
upset.
They are hurt that Nipsey Hussle was shot and killed. They say he was here to give back to the community.
Nipsey Hussle, as the clip says, was shot while in front of his clothing store in Los Angeles last year.
Yeah.
And his impact and influence has really been very visible following his death. What did he mean to you?
Yeah, I think it hit me. I mean, I knew a lot of his collaborators while he was around, but I don't think it was till after his death that his message and his spirit hit me. And I felt like it was a call to action. I just didn't want his life to be in vain. And it just inspired me to bring to action, to do what he was doing. You know, I just felt like if we mirrored what he did around the world, it could be a special thing.
And mirroring what he did by buying back the block, by investing in his community and investing in our communities.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I have an initiative right now with Liberty Bank here in New Orleans where we are focusing on that, you know, talking about banking black and understanding the more we invest in those banks, the more they can loan to people like us.
I also want to ask you about the song MAGA featuring political commentator Angela Rye. Let's listen to some of it.
I can't believe that we're still going through the same thing. Sometimes it gets so bad I can't even handle it. If I see another black boy die at the hands of this, I don't know. Don't want to lose control.
P. PJ, this song speaks really to the optimism that black people have embodied throughout history. Are you an optimistic person?
I'd like to think I am. Yeah, yeah. Nothing lasts forever. You know, seasons change, as does the weather. Yeah, I just believe that what my ancestors went through, we're still here and still surviving. There are always dark times, and I think the dark times make you appreciate the better days, you know. And I just feel like we're in a pretty dark time right now. But I just don't believe it'll last always.
What strikes me is how dynamic you are on stage. What do you enjoy most about performing live?
I think it's the connection. Being a church kid, a preacher's kid who grew up in church and watched the call and response was always my favorite thing. Hearing people scream out, hearing people be impacted immediately. You know, it's such an instant gratification thing. I love to play and see people react to it right there in that moment. There's nothing like that.
I started off talking about how you almost thought about not moving forward with a solo career, and you broke through that, and you're headed back on tour with Maroon 5 after your tour is done. Mm-hmm. What's next for you after all of this?
What I'm focusing on now is making sure that it doesn't stop with me, you know, that there's some legacy there. Working on a new studio here in New Orleans, and got Morton Records and the Morton Records publishing side where I'm signing writers and producers. But I want to see them have careers and see them write big songs and become amazing artists themselves. So a lot of my energy now is going towards making sure that there's more music after me. That's become really important to me.
PJ Morton, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's the Grammy-nominated artist PJ Morton, who's up for multiple awards this year, including Best R&B Album. Yes, it will be all right. And other contenders for Best R&B Album this year include BJ the Chicago Kid, Ella May, Anderson .Paak, and Lucky Day.
Virginia Governor Ralph Northam has declared a state of emergency ahead of a gun rights rally planned for Monday in Richmond. Law enforcement is on alert ahead of that rally. They're concerned that white supremacist groups will be there and that it could take a violent turn. In response, the governor has also temporarily banned weapons from the state capitol grounds. Joining us now is Lisa Hagen. She is a reporting fellow with the public radio collaboration Guns in America. She is based at WABE in Atlanta, and she will be at that rally on Monday. Lisa, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
This week, the FBI arrested three men who were suspected of being members of a neo-Nazi hate group. They were planning to go to this rally in Richmond. So what else do we know about who's going to be there? I mean, is this a guns rally or a white supremacy rally?
It is definitely a gun rights rally. And I think it's really important to say that the vast majority of the people planning to attend this are likely to be law-abiding gun owners who are upset about proposed gun regulations in the Virginia General Assembly. Democrats won majorities in the state House and Senate there this past November, and the possibility of stricter new gun regulation there became much, much more likely than in the past 26 years.
What kind of gun laws are they considering at the legislature?
A few measures just passed the state Senate there this week. They include bills that would require background checks on all firearms purchases. Another one would let municipalities ban weapons from certain events and government buildings. And another one that folks are upset about is capping handgun purchases at one per month.
Hmm. Okay, so this is mostly about guns, but it does seem like there could be people there who are supporters of racist views. How's that playing out?
Well, what's been making a lot of headlines regarding this rally is the prospect of militia groups. The people organizing this rally are the Virginia Citizens Defense League. It's a local gun rights advocacy group there. And this is just their annual lobby day in Richmond. Advocacy groups of all kinds hold these kinds of events in state capitals across the country every year, where they invite constituents to come meet lawmakers and lobby for their cause. But the Virginia Citizens Defense League president explicitly welcomed militia groups to this rally because they are very frequently supporters of gun rights, and he wanted them to provide what he called security for the event. And that's raised a lot of concerns, and that ultimately led to the governor declaring this state of emergency that banned guns on the Capitol grounds.
Are people drawing comparisons to what happened in Charlottesville in 2017 when a counter-protester was killed at that Unite the Right rally? Many others were injured. I mean, is that on people's mind?
Yeah. Ralph Northam, the governor of Virginia, said that his office had received credible intelligence from law enforcement agencies of threats of violence. And he said, quote, "This includes extremist rhetoric similar to what has been seen before in major incidents such as Charlottesville."
All right. That's Lisa Hagan, a reporting fellow with the public radio collaboration Guns in America. She's based at WABE in Atlanta, traveling to Richmond for this rally on Monday. We're going to keep an eye on it. Thank you very much, Lisa.
Thank you.
It's turning out to be an unusual flu season. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the B strain of the flu virus is getting more people sick this season. That strain of the flu doesn't usually develop until later in the year, and the B strain is more dangerous for children. Joining us now is Anthony Fauci. He's director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Dr. Fauci, welcome back.
Good to be with you.
And that B strain of the flu virus hasn't been this prominent in almost 30 years. What should we know about it?
Well, the B strain, as you said correctly, is one that is generally a problem for children. We're having an unusual flu season in that early on, the B strain predominated, which made it particularly difficult for children. So when you look at this year and the number of infections that we're seeing a lot of them in the sense of numbers of infections that parallel some of the worst years that we've seen. Yet the number of total deaths and hospitalizations are less than some of the bad years that we have. However, when you look at the impact on children, there are more deaths among children at this time of the season compared to many of the other seasons. So when you're talking about hospitalizations and seriousness and death in general, it's not a very bad year, but for the children, it is. And that's predominantly due to the fact that the B strain of influenza predominated early on and continues to do a fair amount of damage.
So if this year's vaccination was made with the expectation that the H3N2 strain would be prominent, that's the A strain, does that mean that this year's flu shot essentially missed the mark?
No, it isn't. It isn't true. The H3, first of all, there are three or four types of flus that circulate. Two Bs, one H3N2, one H1N1. The virus that's in the vaccine that we've administered this year is a very good match for the H1N1. But unfortunately, for the Victoria strain of B, which is one of the two Bs that circulate, the match isn't that good. So the double problem that we're seeing with children is that the B is predominating, and yet the vaccine, particularly the Victoria one, is not totally well matched. That doesn't mean it's not going to provide some protection, nor does it mean that it isn't worth getting vaccinated. It's still overwhelmingly better to get vaccinated than not get vaccinated. But I don't think you should say that the vaccine this year is a real problem in the sense it's not doing any protecting. Even when there isn't a perfect match, you get a great deal of benefit out of a vaccine.
And just really quickly, because when you say kids are getting sick this flu season at a higher rate, that might worry parents. What should they know?
Well, they should know they should vaccinate their children. I mean, that's really the underlying message that's underscored by what we're seeing. It is not too late to get vaccinated, even though we're in the middle of January. Anyone 6 months of age or older should get vaccinated.
All right. Dr. Anthony Fauci is director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Dr. Fauci, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Very good to be with you.
This is a sound that you don't hear very often in America anymore. An industrial sewing machine cranking out something to wear inside a factory. It's rare because the vast majority of U.S. apparel is made overseas. So what will it take to get that Made in the USA label back into some of your clothes? Pietro Rivoli is an economist at Georgetown University and author of The Travels of a T-Shirt in a Global Economy. Professor, welcome. And I know this is a little flippant, but is anyone making clothes in America anymore?
So more than 95% of American apparel is imported. So that means there is somebody making clothes in America. There are not that many people.
Just not much. But it didn't used to be that way, right? Because if you look at the numbers, the production started to drop off, what, something like 20 years ago or something? What happened? Was it NAFTA? Was it new trade deals? Why?
Well, really, as recently as 1990, about half of our apparel was made at home in the U.S. A couple of things happened. First of all, the trade rules liberalized. That involved, first of all, China being admitted to the World Trade Organization, and also the U.S. went from having quantitative limits on how much apparel could be imported from a variety of countries to having those limits go away. Basically, the gate kind of opened.
But it is true. Now, if you fast forward to 2020, I mean, if you look at the numbers again, it looks like Made in America is at least trying to make some sort of comeback.
Absolutely. We see the past couple years of data, we've seen that curve kind of move the other way a little bit. There are a couple of reasons for that. One reason is it's always easier to do things closer to home. You know, you don't have to deal with transportation and logistics. You don't have to deal with waiting a long time for your goods to arrive. You don't have to deal with trade barriers. So there's all kinds of reasons that companies, you know, other things equal, would rather be producing here in the U.S.
Always easier, but not always cheaper.
Well, that was exactly the calculation that companies were doing all those years. You know, they were looking at, on the one hand, the much lower cost that they could achieve by going to particularly China for apparel production. And they were weighing that against all of these other factors. What's happened in the past couple years is that calculation has shifted.
Is one of those reasons that companies are listening to their customers and that American consumers are starting to sort of pay attention to this more?
I do think there's a relatively small segment of consumers who are influenced by the notion of Made in America. The bigger issue is that technology is changing very, very rapidly. You know, the whole reason that it was cheaper to move apparel production to Asia was because of the difference in labor costs. You know, wages were just much lower, and apparel traditionally was a very labor-intensive product to make. You know, you needed lots and lots of people sitting at sewing machines. But gradually over time, you know, technology has improved and, you know, various parts of this process have been mechanized. And as we can start to replace people with machines, you know, you lose some of that original motivation for going abroad.
So you're saying maybe automation is starting to make a difference to bring some of these jobs back to the United States, but could you bring it back in any meaningful way? I mean, you know, what would it take to see those numbers that we had in the 1990s, for instance?
Well, remember, automation doesn't mean bringing jobs back. It means bringing production back. You know, a very, very simple example, when I was studying T-shirts, about 15 or so years ago, they figured out a way to basically knit the body of a T-shirt in a tube. If you look at a very old T-shirt, it has side seams, which means that, you know, a human being had to sit down and stitch those. So little by little, you know, these steps in the process have been mechanized. We can now make things, you know, like socks and pillowcases without any people at all. You don't need a person at a sewing machine. So I expect that trend to continue.
But does that mean that that T-shirt without the seams down the side is being made in the United States? Or can that still be done more cheaply in a place like China or Bangladesh?
So the more you mechanize it, the more the cost advantage tilts back to the U.S. or countries like the U.S. It is certainly still cheaper to produce clothing in Asia than it is in the United States. But that gap is narrowing over time.
So what would you say to a small batch manufacturer in the United States who's sort of just starting out, trying to make clothes here? What's the key to their success, and how steep is the mountain they're climbing?
I think there is a market, you know, for companies like that. I think there are consumers who are interested in Made in America. I do not think all apparel production is going to be back in the United States, but I think there is a, you know, a competitive space in this industry for companies that can be quick and close to their customers and address some of these trade policy uncertainties. And so there's definitely room in the market.
That was Georgetown University Professor Pietra Rivoli. And later, we'll go inside an American factory to see the sewing machines at work and to talk to the people who are trying to bring back the art of making clothes in America.
It comes too late for her father, but thanks to the efforts of a Michigan woman, former prisoners of war of all rank are now eligible for burial with full military honors at Arlington National Cemetery. That change was included in the National Defense Authorization Act, signed by President Trump in December. Kanda Fletcher started this fight after her father, Robert, died in 2018. He survived nearly 3 years as a prisoner of war during the Korean War. He was buried at Arlington, but not with full military honors because he was not eligible. Kanda Fletcher joins us now. Kanda, welcome.
Thank you.
This, of course, is especially important to you because your father and his experience was a significant one, and your family only learned he wasn't eligible for a full military honor burial after his death because of his rank. Tell us more.
That's correct. We had always assumed that because my dad qualified for burial in Arlington based on him having been a former prisoner of war, that because of the former prisoner of war status, he would be entitled to a full military honors burial. And it wasn't until after he had died that we learned from the funeral director that he was not.
What does a burial with full military honors look like?
That includes the caisson, which is the horse drawn, bringing the casket to the grave, and a military band from your branch of service. It also includes taps, folding of the flag, and a chaplain.
When your father was a prisoner of war, he experienced hunger and freezing temperatures and psychological abuse. How did that affect the rest of his life when he came home?
My dad never stopped living the war. There's never in my life I can recall a time that my father ever closed his eyes to try to sleep that he wasn't fighting the war. You could hear what he was saying. You could see his body moving as he was probably defending himself and his fellow soldiers. He went with severe depression and PTSD that were undiagnosed for decades and didn't even exist when he came home from Korea, to the point where he had was suicidal at one point. And my mother was able to talk him into going to the VA and getting connected with services there, which I think really turned things around for him.
Hmm. You lived with that and you saw him experiencing that. Did he ever talk openly with you or other family members about his war experience?
My dad did, but most of a lot of his speaking of the war came from public speaking. He would talk to school groups of many different ages from elementary school up. He was actually the national commander of the American ex-POWs. I would go and listen to what those men had to say, the former POWs. And the biggest connection was it didn't matter who was talking. Their experience was somewhat different, but every one of those men went through the same horror. Every one of them.
Mm-hmm. You know, I want to ask you about something. The Army was segregated when your dad, who was a Black American, served. How did that impact his ability to earn a rank higher than private?
He in all likelihood, would not have been able to, even if he had chosen to stay in the Army and become, for example, career. Many of the men who actually survived and came back with him are men of color. Even if not African-American, they'd still be considered men of color by today's standards. And I think one of the biggest things I'm really proud of that this amendment to the USC, the US Code, has done is we've removed the issue of race from burial at Arlington for the former POWs. Now these men that earn that privilege by having been a former POW, doesn't matter what color his skin was now, doesn't matter what their rank was, they can be buried at Arlington with the same privileges as an officer who's qualified to be buried there.
What do you think your dad would say about what you've done?
I think that my father, if he had been, was here and was physically able, would do some handstands. I really do. I feel like I'm, in a way, I'm carrying on his work because he got very, very involved with helping former POWs and veterans who had service-connected disabilities to get services from the VA. I feel like I'm carrying that on because my dad, there are still some former POWs living that my family knows, that I know. And now if those men want to be buried in Arlington with full honors, they can be. And it was just so humiliating for me to learn that my dad could not and would not receive full honors. And I tried. I did the whole appeal thing, and it was denied. And we weren't going to change it at that point. But with the help of a friend, Monica Cash, who put me in connection with Matt Burke from the Stars and Stripes, who ran that first article, that's what got things going. That's what brought this to the attention of Congress.
That's Kanda Fletcher. She fought for full military honor burials at Arlington National Cemetery for prisoners of war and Medal of Honor recipients on behalf of her late father, Army Private Robert Fletcher. Kanda, thank you so much.
Thank you for your time today. I appreciate it.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Kansas lawmakers reached a bipartisan deal to approve Medicaid expansion, and Democratic Governor Laura Kelly tells us other red states that want to expand Medicaid could look to the Kansas model.
It is simple, it is clean, it's about as inexpensive an approach you can take.
A conversation with the governor of Kansas next time on Here and Now.